Four members are present. Senator Dyson, Senator Passman, Vice Chair, Senator Ellis, and Senator Davis, Chair. We have one bill to come before us today. And Thomas is on his way. I will just go on and get started so we can hear from administration and anyone else that might be signed up to testify. Senate Bill 238. This bill has been introduced on this side as a request from the House side. They do have that bill over on the other side. And in order to get more information about the need and the concern here, I thought it would be best for me to mirror that bill and bring it forward. I bought it as an individual because I didn't have time to get with the committee to see if they wanted it to come as a committee bill. And at this time, if you have on your cell phones on you, please turn them off. Put them on vibrate. That would be appreciated. I'm going to let Mr. Overmyer give an overview of the bill, and then we'll call on administration to come forward.
For the record, I'm Tom Overmyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you today is Senate Bill 238. It's an act amending the eligibility threshold for medical assistance for persons in a medical or intermediate care facility. In 2003, the legislature changed Alaska Statute Section 47.07.020B, as in boy, subsection 6, the Medicaid long-term services income eligibility limit for persons in medical or intermediate care facilities from 300% supplemental income security to an equivalent fixed dollar amount at $1,656 per month. This change created an income ceiling for waiver eligibility, effectively freezing the eligibility limit for the last 7 years rather than allowing the limit to adjust annually in tandem with the SSI. The result was that small Social Security cost of living adjustments have disqualified many needy disabled people from the program. Near the end of 2008, many individuals who were aged, blind, or disabled and requiring institutional care received notices that they would no longer be eligible for the home and community-based services waivers after the 2009 cost of living adjustment went into effect. Because the waiver eligibility limits no longer increased with the cost of living, it placed a number of people over the $1,656 per month limit, or 300% of the 2003 SSI benefit rate. The 2009 income equivalent at 300% SSI was $2,022 per month. I refer you to the fiscal note attached. Alternatives for preserving eligibility, particularly for those requiring lifetime or long-term care, include creation of a Medicaid qualifying income trust, also known as a Miller Trust. Trusts have procedural drawbacks, including numerous responsibilities and restrictions, limited access to income, access or assistance of an attorney and a trustee to manage trust assets. The Supplemental Security Income Program is a federal needs-based disability program for low-income adults over age 65, blind, or disabled. For an adult, the SSI disability requirement is based on the ability to work. An adult is considered disabled if the person cannot do the work that he or she performed before the disability occurred or cannot do alternate work because of a severe physical or mental condition. For a child to be eligible, he or she must suffer from serious physical and or mental problems. For both adults and children, the disability must last or are expected to last for at least a year. Mm-hmm. Medicaid services are critical to the well-being of Alaska's most vulnerable citizens. Supporting SB 238 will ensure that eligible Alaskans can continue to receive nursing home care and in-home services. It will also save the legislature from amending statutes every year or two as the federal poverty level guidelines and supplemental security income levels increase with the cost of living. And I would note for the record that it has a zero fiscal note with a good deal of written analysis from the department.
We'll let the department speak to that. Are there any questions at this point, or would you be okay with the administration coming forward? Mr. Sherwood, do you want to come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. For the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services. As stated previously, this bill would increase the income standard used to determine Medicaid eligibility for people who are in nursing homes or receiving our home and community-based waivered services, basically people who meet an institutional level of care. It would allow the income standard to increase according to cost of living increases granted under the federal supplemental security income program, and that's the same kind of increases that people, cost of living adjustments people get in their Social Security payments as well. Currently, people who are over income for this category of Medicaid, because of the large expense of providing services, either nursing home or waivered services, use a device called a qualifying income trust or Miller Trust to reduce their accountable income for Medicaid below the income standard currently 1656 and qualify for Medicaid. As a result, we have not seen people losing Medicaid eligibility as a result of this standard being fixed in law. However, they are at best subject to significant inconvenience getting a trust. It can be expense, and it can, in some cases, impose hardships on them and their family to try and manage the trust. We do not anticipate, as I said, that raising the need standard will add more people to the Medicaid program. Therefore, we are assuming a zero fiscal note. I did want to point out one thing about this category of Medicaid, because it's a little bit complicated. People who meet this institutional level of care and are in a nursing home or on a waiver program are subject to a calculation that's called the cost of care calculation that takes place after we determine their eligibility. And they're basically, that calculation takes all their income and provides some deductions. The big one is a personal needs allowance, but also to support a spouse living in the community or other dependents, medical expenses that aren't covered by the Medicaid program, and some other deductions as well. Once we do that calculation, we determine an amount of money people have to pay toward their cost of care. They pay their providers for a portion of the care. And that, in turn, reduces the amount we pay out to the providers to provide that care. I raise that because this proposed change in the statute would not affect the personal needs allowance. That's set in regulation, and we are assuming that we will keep the personal needs allowance at its current levels for the time being. If we were to increase those personal needs allowance, it would decrease the amount of money people are paying in their cost of care, and would in fact have a fiscal impact on the program. So I did want to make that clear. This would get a number of people out of the problem of having to go and get a trust, and it would allow that standard to move with the adjustments of cost of living to the SSI program. But I just wanted to make sure folks understood their cost of care and their personal needs allowance are separate, and we're not proposing to change the personal needs allowances as part of this. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions? I see two hands here, and I'll start over here with, excuse me. I have a senior moment. So I can think of your name.
Right.
Dyson. Senator Dyson. Excuse me.
For these folks that are institutionalized, give me a couple of different scenarios of where their income comes from.
The most, through the chair, Senator Dyson, the most common source of income would be a Social Security payment or another retirement payment state retirement, federal retirement, or private retirement payment. Those two in combination are probably the most common sources of income that folks would have. Some people would qualify for Social Security disability benefits. If people are receiving cash assistance from the state, they don't fit under this category. They're fit under another category of Medicaid, so they're not really subject to these standards or to that whole cost of care stuff I was talking about.
Let me follow up here to
yes.
like get a hold of them. So why wouldn't we want them to go ahead and exhaust this other source of income and use that to pay their bills?
Through the chair, we do in fact require people to use their income to pay toward the cost of their care after we apply certain deductions to that income. Some of them are explicitly set out under federal law. The personal needs allowance is subject to some degree of flexibility by the state, but we have set levels that we think will afford people enough funds to support themselves in their living situation. It is a different level for nursing homes than for assisted living homes than for somebody living in their own home. Essentially, it goes up. And one of the reasons, forgive me, I'll try and stay out of the weeds, but in nursing homes, the Medicaid payment includes a payment for room and board. In other settings, by federal law, we're prohibited from paying for room and board. So in some of these situations, people are having to pay, either they're having to pay their rent or pay their living costs directly, or they're having to pay an assisted living home a separate fee for room and board that isn't reimbursed by Medicaid. So the notion is we want to give people a personal needs allowance that does allow them to meet their living expenses in the community. And as I said, we're not proposing to increase those allowances as if this bill passes. That's we're not assuming that we're going to increase those standards.
Kat, I'm embarrassed that I don't understand. We are raising the limit, or proposing to, so people can have more income of their own, that own personal private income, and not be disqualified from getting these categories of public payment. Correct?
Through the chair, correct. I would say, I would characterize this as this bill, it would increase the standard we use to determine whether someone is eligible for Medicaid. It will not increase the amount of money we let them keep and not before they have to start paying their providers for their cost of their care. So in...
Say the first sentence again.
We will increase the income standard we use to determine whether they're eligible for Medicaid, but we are not increasing, this would not increase the standard that we use to determine how much money they get to keep once they have been determined eligible for Medicaid.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that what you just said is very carefully said and very important.
Through the chair, in federal terms, they refer to this cost of care calculation as post-eligibility, something that happens after you've determined somebody eligible. You say they are entitled to this benefit, then you go, and after that, you go and you figure out how much money they have to pay toward their care. But those are two separate calculations. They're not done at the same time, and they don't use the same rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Passman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
maybe another way to help in this concept is, what is the range or the estimate of range of the net amount of monies that are in these Miller trusts? And as I understand what you're saying, is that these are used to pay living expenses separate and apart from this program. Is that, let me ask that first.
Through the chair, there are limits on the amount of money that can be made available to the individual through the Miller Trust directly. That money is typically used to pay for their room and their board and their other living expenses. Each trust can be written differently and tailored toward the needs of the individual, or it can, some are written somewhat generically to try and be as flexible as possible. There is the cost of care calculation I referred to earlier. Really, the best way to put it is, it pretty much ignores the existence of a Miller Trust. The Miller Trust, the qualifying income trust, is used to determine eligibility. And then when we determine the cost of care, we essentially pretend like it doesn't exist and they have access to all their money, all the income that goes into the trust. So I don't know if that helps your understanding or hinders your understanding, but that's the best way I know how to put it.
You may continue.
Thank you. Maybe another way to approach it is what happens to any money within the Miller Trust upon death?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Passman, for people in this income group, they tend not to accumulate money in this trust. If they do accumulate money in the trust, then it goes to reimburse the Medicaid program for expenses incurred on their behalf while they were receiving their care. So we do recapture some money at the end of the life of the trust if some accumulates. Typically, because of the cost of care calculation, most trusts don't accumulate significant amounts of money.
It's not a savings account.
Through the chair, the qualifying income trust, the Miller Trust, one attorney refers to it as a flush trust, because the money tends to come in each month and go out each month, either to support the individual or to pay for their cost of care obligation. There are some situations where money will get retained, and if it does, then it would go to the state upon the person's death. It would go to reimburse the state for expenses.
You may continue. Yes.
So one need not establish a Miller Trust if the limits are raised up to this $2,000 amount, whatever that, $2,022. So you would not have to have a Miller Trust if your income is less than $2,022. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. And then in order to establish a Miller Trust, what is the expense that a typical recipient would have to incur, either on an initial setup basis or on a repetitive basis? What cost do they incur?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, there are people in this audience that can probably give you a more current price list than I can. When I was working more closely with trust policy, it ran between approximately $800 and a couple $1,000s to set up a trust. Depending on which attorney you went to and what your needs were, some people were at that time were able to get trust free or reduced charge through legal services or pro bono arrangements. But But that was the range of expenses that I was seeing when I oversaw Medicaid trust.
One last question.
Yes.
Thank you. So by raising the limits, essentially, the recipient doesn't have to spend this $800 to $2,000. They can earn up to $2,200 a month. They don't have to go in and spend $800 to $2,000. That can go to their other costs that are attendant with their life.
Through the chair, Senator Passman, that's correct. If their income fell below the $2,022 where it's currently, they would not need to establish a trust. They would save that expense. They would save themselves the burden of trust accounting. They would save themselves the need having to find a trustee, a reputable person that could act as their trustee, and administer the trust and report on the trust activities to our Division of Public Assistance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sherwood.
Hey, thank you. Any other questions? I want to recognize Senator Thomas. He's joined us a few minutes ago while we were under the discussion.
And I did have a question, if I could.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sorry to be late and hope I won't ask a question already been asked, but you talk about Miller Trust. And my only experience with Miller Trust is generally is a very simple transaction, and usually, and I may be wrong here, although I see there are a couple of groupings in the legislation itself that seems to include folks that I did not realize were covered by Miller Trust. The ones I thought were generally covered was folks who basically had divested themselves of basically everything that they owned, but yet had Social Security coming in. Social Security, as my understanding, will not pay into a Miller Trust, but the money is generally transferred to pay the cost of care and everything other than a small amount, $50 to $100 or something like that, allowed to be retained by the individual for personal expenses. So I guess my question is, are there other groups of folks that I'm not aware of that generally have Miller Trusts and actually have some assets that are in excess of what is allowed under state assistance laws and others on an annual basis?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, a Miller Trust is used only for income. So there are an asset test for this category of Medicaid that would be affected by the bill as well. That's $2,000 in assets. If you have a spouse living in the community, you're allowed a generous spousal deduction, and some assets are exempt, like your home, your car. So to use a Miller Trust, people still have to divest themselves of their countable assets down below the asset standard.
Right.
Generally speaking, the people who use a Miller Trust are in a situation where they have some kind of retirement or disability income in excess of the standards here. And it is used most commonly by people who are in nursing homes or qualify for our home and community-based waivers because of the large expense of providing those kind of services.
And just for my phone.
You may.
In that case, though, where they have other funds, are not those funds generally directed to the facility that they're at, because they have to basically at the end of each year account for and address those assets and not be in excess of what is allowed, so that realistically $2,000 is what it amounts to. We can give or take a little bit here or there, get through part of the year, but sooner or later somebody's going to have to take that $3,000 that they've built up maybe, and they're going to have to pay that facility.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, people, especially in nursing homes, have to pay most of their income toward their cost of care, so they tend not to accumulate money. If they do accumulate money that would take them over the $2,000, then they need to find a way to spend that money in a way that doesn't also create problems for their eligibility. For instance, they can't convert that money to another countable asset, from cash to stocks or jewelry or something like that. Typically, if they have no other need that needs to be met, we might recommend that they simply pay their provider an additional sum of money toward the cost of care. Or they might have other unpaid health expenses or some other need that they need to meet. All of their income coming in is subject to a cost of care calculation that would require that they, after they receive their personal needs allowance and other deductions, take the remainder of their money and apply it toward their cost of care.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much. We might have to call on you again, but we'll go on with the list. Is that Mr. Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm suffering from a cold here.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Vance Sanders. I'm an attorney here in Juneau, Alaska. I started out with Alaska Legal Services in 1984 and have been practicing law here for, well, I knew you, Senator Ellis, when you worked for Don Clarkson. So how long ago has that been? Long time ago. For many, many years. I'm also the president of Alaska Legal Services Corporation, but I'm not speaking today on behalf of legal services, just my experience as an attorney dealing with people who are in the situation that hopefully this bill will help ameliorate. I am strongly in support of SB 238 for a few reasons. First of all, this would change the income, the way income is calculated. And from some of the questions, let me back up, because this is a complicated area of the law. And when I talk to lawyers through the bar, I do continuing legal educations for the lawyers, and I always have to start with three basic steps. So I'm hoping, I mean, you may have a little bit more experience than they do, but let me just start where I do with them. There are three things that someone has to do to qualify for Medicaid in this situation. Their countable resources have to be below a federally determined limit, depending on whether they're married or single. That's $2,000 per single individual. If you're married, that limit is $109,640 for a community spouse this year. You don't count certain things like homes that you live in that are under a certain value of $500,000, a car that you may have. So you have to meet the resource requirements. Also, your level of care has to be either skilled nursing or intermediate, which means that if you qualify for Medicaid, you have to be basically unable to care for yourself. And the third criterion is you have to have income below a certain amount that was frozen in time by the state of Alaska in 2003, artificially at the SSI limit at that time of 1656. When I say the SSI limit, there are two parts of the Social Security Act that are important here. SSI is the federal dollars that you get when you're determined to be disabled by the federal government and you haven't paid money into the system, the insurance program. You're low income, you have few resources, but you meet the disability test. That's called the SSI limit, and that's Title 16 of the Federal Social Security Act. Title 2 is the insured status. It's the same disability test, but your resources are not relevant. It's just like a federal insurance program for people who are disabled. So in 2003, the state of Alaska made a policy decision that they wanted to freeze in time the amount of the income limit for people who qualified for Medicaid, and that's primarily home and community-based waivers, so people are at home getting Medicaid, long-term care, so Wildflower Court in Juneau, other places in Anchorage, you know, there's many long-term care centers across Alaska. In the last few years, we've actually allowed people to get Medicaid in Pioneer's homes, so this actually has a Pioneer home aspect as well. People who meet those criteria for the last, since 2003, as their income has gone up through whatever source, Social Security, they get the COLA every year, if they get private retirement, their income has gone up, and as they've needed to meet that 1656 income criterion, we've had to use the artificial device of a Miller Trust to do that. And what has happened is there have been people caught, you know, as their federal benefits have gone up since 2003, their income limit has gone above that 1656, and the only way to artificially reduce their income is through a trust. Now that sounds like that's an easy thing to do, but let me just walk you through what these people are already dealing with. You have people who are at home who can't care for themselves in a nursing home or Pioneer's home, who are already in triage. I mean, they're, you know, people have left their home. They haven't left it willingly. They've gone to a nursing home. My father's in a temporary nursing home in North Carolina right now. I talked to him on Saturday, and he sure doesn't want to be there. But he had hip replacement surgery, and he wants to go home. And most people in my experience who are in nursing homes don't want to be there. So you're dealing with that situation, and then you have the artificial device of a trust. And these trusts sound like they're a simple thing, but they're not. When I do a trust, and I bet I do on average, Mr. Sherwood would have a better idea, or Mr. Steele, but I bet on average I do 50 to 75 income trusts. The average cost, depending on where you are in Juneau, and depending on who the client is and his or her situation, is anywhere from $500 to $1,000, which for people who are making, you know, $2,000 a month or $1,700 a month doesn't sound like much, but it's a lot of money for them. In Anchorage, my understanding is working with other attorneys, that amount is up to $2,000 for a single trust fee, which, you know, given their situations, it, again, is a significant amount of money. So, and when you do these trusts, there are 24 pages. It's a fairly standard trust, but what you have to do is you have to incorporate all of this federal law and all of this state law, and you have to anticipate that this person may go from what we call walking around Medicaid, which means he or she may get out of the nursing home, go back on the street for a while, live at home for a while, but then they may fall and break a hip like or hurt themselves and go back in the hospital and be discharged to a long-term care, rehabilitate, go back home, and this, you know, it's like the yo-yo situation. So you have to anticipate in these trusts that all these situations have to be anticipated. So when I do a trust, I do it anticipating three different scenarios: walking around Medicaid, home and community-based Medicaid, or nursing home Medicaid. And by the way, those will also work for Pioneers Home. It's a slightly different test, but they will work. So you've got a 24-page trust. You've got a family in crisis. In Juneau, at least, there used to be two or three trustees, unless you are fortunate enough to have the Office of Public Advocacy appointed as your conservator or guardian. There really are no trustees in Juneau, and it's a chronic problem throughout Alaska. So you've got a 24-page complicated trust, which has to be registered with the Superior Court. You have to get an EIN number from the IRS because it's a separate legal entity. You have to have a bank account that's separately established. It just has trust money going in it. And I don't call them a flush trust. I call them a tide trust because the money flows in and out every month. So these are complicated things, and you have someone who is not qualified generally by education or inclination to administer them. You have an annual review by the state of Alaska, and it is an amazingly difficult thing for these families to pull off. How does this help? This raises that artificial limit, and it's artificial. Believe me, it was just a number chosen and frozen in time. It raises it and ties it to the federal SSI limit, and as that goes up, the income limit goes up, and that will avoid the need for a lot of families to have to come up with the money to pay for these trusts and a lot of families to have to go through this trust experience. So I see this as a pro-family bill. I agree with Mr. Sherwood. I don't think there's going to be any fiscal note. It's not going to change the cost of care calculation for what's called post-eligibility. So I'm very much in support of this. And I have to tell you, I have an economic interest not to be in support because I do a lot of these trusts, but I think it's the right thing for these families, and I strongly am in support of it. I'm happy to take any questions. I hope that helps a bit, Madam Chair.
It helps quite a bit, and I appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions from the members?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Murray Darling, you want to come forward? Darling.
For the record, my name is Marie Darling, and I represent the AARP Capital City Task Force. And you will have a letter of support which says that we certainly support this legislation and urge you to pass it. And I'm very fortunate to follow Mr. Sanders because his explanation was really wonderful and I hope answered a lot of questions. I'm familiar with some of this because last year, when you go back to what creates the need for a Miller Trust, where I live in Fireweed Place, we had several people there due to the fact there was an increase in Social Security last year. Several people fell off of their Medicaid provisions and all and had to begin looking at a Miller Trust. And when they began looking into it, were absolutely just, you know, didn't know what to do, knew they didn't have the money to pay for it. A lot of them just gave up. A few of them did, with the help of family or something, create one. And what they were required to do, the family was just amazed. So I'm very glad for this explanation of what you go through to even establish a Miller Trust. But AARP really supports this because it was a concern of ours at the time in 2003 when the figure that was used then was frozen in time, as you might say. Did not allow for any of the increases in Social Security or even, say, a federal or state retirement. And many of those people with those retirements may not fall into this category. But then again, we know that most of the beneficiaries of this bill and all the things that follow with Medicare are not well off financially in no way at all. And they are at risk both economically and then from a health standpoint. Because you can see what kinds of problems some of this would create, and the fact that if they don't get the care and are not able to stay at home as long as possible, then it gets to the point where it's an even increasing amount then that's going to be paid out when they end up in long-term care facilities. And since we want to keep people in their homes as long as possible, and that's what they want to do, anything we can do to help that is what's going to really help the state overall. And so we do want to say that this will help then continuing to support the long-term, the home and community-based services, which is what are really needed, and all the other facilities then that people end up in is the next step. So we really do recommend that you put this on a basis where then you don't have to go in every couple of years and change the amount and leave it at a percentage of whatever they deem is necessary. And we feel that it needs to go back up to the 300% of SSI, which is what it was previously. And I think that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you for your testimony.
Really appreciate it.
Any questions or comments to Marie? Here, none. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Holly Handler.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. Thank you for your consideration of this bill. I am an attorney here in Juneau, Alaska, and I represent primarily low-income and elderly clients, and I set up Miller Trusts for clients and assist in problems that occur during the lifetime of these trusts. In December 2008, because the adjustment of the Medicaid standard to SSI was not in place, there were dozens of Alaskans across the state who received a notice that their benefits were being canceled because of a small cost of living increase in Social Security. For some people who I represented, they were $1 or $2 or $5 over the Medicaid income limit. And because of that problem, they had to set up this Miller Trust, which is an irrevocable trust, which means that this trust will last for their lifetime, or unless a judge dissolves it upon a petition in court. Mr. Sanders touched upon some issues with setting up and maintaining this trust, and I just wanted to add to that the experience of my clients who have had trusts. In initially setting up the trusts, a client needs to find a reliable trustee. Like Mr. Sanders mentioned, there are people who are blessed with caring and devoted families who will serve as trustee to manage the trust account. But other people, many of whom I've represented, don't have a family member in town or anywhere. Some clients I've had are widows who don't have trusted family members, they don't have friends in the community, and they don't have anyone they know at all who they can trust to turn over their entire finances to. And to be clear, when a trustee becomes responsible for a Miller Trust, they become responsible for the person's entire income. their entire income goes into the Miller Trust, and the trustee is responsible for administering that. So they're turning over their income in terms of being able to pay all their bills. They're also turning over responsibility for maintaining their Medicaid eligibility, because if the trustee manages the trust irresponsibly or otherwise incorrectly, their Medicaid eligibility can be jeopardized. So in December 2008, when this most recent Social Security COLA went into effect and people became slightly over income and had to set up these trusts, I represented two clients who didn't have family. They didn't have anyone they could trust to serve as trustee. In one of these cases, they found a niece out of state who could manage their trust, signed all the trust documents, went through the process of setting up the bank account, signing the trust documents, working with a lawyer, establishing a tax identification number, maintaining records to meet the Department of Public Assistance annual audit, and did that for some time. However, between December 2008 and now, that client's relative out of state decided that their financial needs were more important, and they took this person's money. And this was a 70-year-old person who couldn't take care of themselves. And with their finances being turned over to the trustee, they couldn't any longer pay their rent, pay their utilities. They became a victim of some just gross and horrendous financial exploitation because they had had to turn over control of their finances to their trustee through their Miller Trust. To rectify the situation, it wasn't simply a matter of changing the trustee through the department. It was a matter of finding an attorney to petition the court, explain in court affidavits why the trustee had to be changed, obtaining a court order, registering that change in trustee with the courts, submitting the documents to the public assistance for approval, submitting legal documents to the bank to change all the trustee information, and not to mention all the work that had to be done with the credit agencies to repair this person's credit because of their irresponsible trustee. In another instance in Ketchikan, there was a gentleman with end stages of Parkinson who had to find a trustee who they were not related to, who they did not know very well, and that trustee proceeded to mismanage their Medicaid account so that their Medicaid became jeopardized months after setting up this trust because of irresponsible management of the trust. I'm testifying in strong support of this bill because not only will it make it easier for existing Medicaid recipients to maintain their eligibility, but it will go a long way to preventing the kind of financial exploitation and abuse of the disabled and elderly that is already a problem in the state and is made worse by the need to have these Miller Trust documents in place. I'd also like to add that I've had the pleasure in the past few years of working with a lot of fine employees, the Department of Public Assistance, Jim Steele included, and whenever these COLAs go into effect through Social Security, and there's dozens and dozens of people across the state that are affected by it, it means that much additional work for the department. Our clients not only have to work with their caseworkers or caseworker supervisors, sometimes the Fair Hearing Office, but between my hours and the department's hours and the Fair Hearing Office hours, it creates an extra burden on the state as well as the Medicaid recipients to deal with the situation. And the bill will just give an adjustment to the standard that will eliminate the need for a lot of that time and effort being spent. Thank you.
I thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Just one.
Yes.
You know, we heard some testimony on setting up the Miller Trust, but we haven't heard the costs of, for example, a trustee if it isn't a family member. And, you know, certainly in the situation when the trustee abuses their fiduciary duty, but what is the typical cost of a trustee if it's not OPA and it's not a family member?
And through the chair, in the trusts I've done where we've had a non-relative trust, the non-relative has charged a fee of approximately $50 per month to manage the trust. And for someone who is just slightly over the income limit, $5 or $10, that means it's a significant extra burden on their finances because they have less than $1,656 a month then to spend on their basic food and shelter and basic life expenses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one other person signed up. Denise Danella.
Good afternoon, Chair Davis and members of this committee. I don't have too much more to add to the previous testimony. The Alaska Commission on Aging is very much in support of passage of this bill. We first became aware of this issue last December was at Christmas time when our office received a number of calls from seniors who received a letter through the mail, bad time of year, Christmas, you know, saying that they were, because of the Social Security cost of living increase that they received, which was in the amount of 5.8%, that they were disqualified from their Medicaid waiver programs, and they were very concerned about that. They called our office to ask for help, and we told them about the Miller Trust and made references to local attorneys as well as to Alaska Legal Services. Luckily, Holly Handler here in Juneau was available to help a lot of these individuals. The other thing that I wanted to point out, one of our concerns with the Miller Trust, besides all the things that were mentioned, has to do with allowable expenses. Now, according to the personal cost allowance, a person is able to have the amount of $1,656 per month. Now, even though they've received a cost of living increase to help them pay for increases due to food and housing, because prices keep on going up every year, heating oil, fuel oil, and Fairbanks keeps on going up, none of these additional funds over the $1,656 may be used to pay for those types of expenses. And for somebody, an elderly person, maybe living in Fairbanks or another cold area of the state, the price of fuel is very high. And so it, by having that amount set at $1,656, which I know is also referred to in regulation, and that's not something that we're necessarily addressing today, but I just wanted to bring your attention to this because Mr. Sherwood also mentioned it as well. That amount has been set in statute since 2003. That's that 300% of SSI number that was set, you know, years ago, 7 years ago. And every year, the cost of inflation, the cost of food, the cost of housing, the cost of fuel oil continues to increase. And for an older person who's living on their own and living on, you know, a fixed income, it becomes more and more difficult to meet the cost of those of just basic living expenses. And we feel that at some point that the department and maybe this committee could take a look at that $1,656 number for personal care allowance to see if there might be any way in which that amount can be raised so that a person who is receiving those COLA adjustments can have access to some of those additional funds to pay for the increased cost of food and housing. It's a good investment, we believe, because if we're able to keep people healthy, have decent housing, stay warm, then they're going to have a better chance of being able to remain independent in their homes. And for every year a person is able to remain independent outside of the nursing home, and not to say that the nursing homes do not have a place in the continuum of care, because they really do, we're saving the state money. Anywhere from, for Medicaid, the Medicaid portion is $80,000 up to $181,000 for a bed in a nursing home. And the cost for an older Alaskan's waiver per person is roughly around $23,000 a year. So anyway, I just wanted to add that to in the conversation in your discussion. Although I know it's not something that we're talking about today, but just wanted to make you aware of that.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Sherwood, would you come up, back up, please? Would you address the situation that Denise spoke to about the money not being able to be used for fuel or food or because of increase? And how it's determined what it can be used for?
Madam Chair, we have, the limiting factor really there is the personal needs allowance when we make the cost of care calculation. There are no restrictions on what that can be used for. Right now, for a person living in their home, it is $1,656 a month. Beyond that, if they have income beyond that amount of money, it would have to qualify for one of our other allowable deductions in calculating it. Now, that can be support of a community spouse, which is, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but up to another, over $2,000 a month if you're supporting a spouse. Or dependents, there are deductions also if you have minor or disabled dependents. Uncovered medical expenses are probably the other really common deduction that's allowed there. But basically, to pay for your own personal food, shelter, and personal items, you'd be limited to the $1,656 a month unless we change our personal needs allowance in regulation.
And that is done through state regulation?
That's done through state regulation.
So you could change that?
We could change it.
Okay. All right, thank you. All right, is there anyone online to nobody? Anybody else in the audience that I didn't call on? At this time, I'm going to close public testimony then. And we are now back to the committee for discussion. The question was asked if I had planned to move this bill out of the committee today, and I said no, I was not, because I thought there was plenty of information that we were going to have to get. I didn't realize that we were going to have such experts to come and testify before us today and really set us straight on some things that I had some concerns about. I don't know how the rest of the members of the committee feels about it. I want to hear what you have in discussion, and if there's something else that you want to do other than what's in this particular bill, I would be interested in working with the department to deal with the regulation part, but I don't want to put that within this bill. But I want to hear what the members have to say.
I don't have a problem if the committee wants to move it today, so it's what Madam Chair's preference is.
I'm of a mind that I'm willing to move it. So it's up to the committee. If you have further information you need to know, I need to know that. If not, I would ask someone to make a motion to move it out of this committee.
Madam Chair, I would move that we advance Senate Bill number 238 with individual recommendations. We have backslash A in front of us with attached zero fiscal note.
Any objection to that? Hearing no objection, so moved. Thank you very much. We do have a joint meeting tomorrow that you need to know about with the House. And what is the topic for tomorrow, please?
Children's justice.
Oh, that is with the Children's Caucus at 3 o'clock?
Right. Mm-hmm. Capitol 106.
Don't we have another, it's on Wednesday?
We have a regular meeting Wednesday.
Oh, I thought we had a joint meeting with the House side.
That's Tuesday. That's tomorrow at 3.
Just 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're going to have that report given to us at 3 o'clock. If it's possible, like, for you to be there, it would be over in the House resource room, I think it is.
Capitol 106.
Okay,
yes.
106.
And everyone should have received the notice and the documents already for that meeting.
Is there anything else to come before us? If not, we'll adjourn.